session number 29566, reel 14.
Then Spicer, reel 14. Len, you mentioned ambushes. How would you lay an ambush?
The usual way that we laid ambushes was if we were ambushing perhaps a track where either information had been received that bandits had been using this track, you would work your way into the area, not directly. You would go in another angle so that if people were observing a military patrol, they might just get the impression that we weren't going to the place that we were supposed to be going, and then you would do a detour. Now, if you were ambushing a track, for example, if you had an ambush party, could consist of a full platoon, or the platoon might be split into perhaps two or three different sections. And if you were ambushing a fairly lengthy track, so if you say, for instance, you've got 15 blokes in a platoon that particular day, if you were going to ambush the track at night, you would put three blocks of five. Now, the idea is, from whichever side the suspected party comes in, be it right or left, the five guys at the end don't open fire. Because what you don't want is for a party coming in from the right or the left to be fired on, and then they will just whiz off. The idea is to allow the two end positions, and we used to call them stops. You might get, in this case, where I said before, you got one brain gun per platoon. You might even have two. So you would get a brain gunner at each end with four other guys making the five, and then in the middle five you've invariably got and with those five you might have an NCO, either a corporal or a lance corporal, so you've always got somebody of rank in charge. Now, in the middle section you might have, well, invariably you would have the platoon commander and the sergeant and three others. Invariably the signaller, who incidentally is all our signallers were armed as well. I mean, although they're carrying a wireless set and their kit, they're armed as well. So they're a fully operational soldier. And possibly the medic, who again is armed. He's a fully operational soldier. And the idea is that from whichever side the opposition comes in, you let them pass the first five, either on the left or on the right. And you wait. The word of command to open fire is usually given by the platoon commander or the platoon sergeant. I mean, in some cases, patrols went out, they didn't have a platoon commander in the form of an officer. A patrol might be taken out by a sergeant. But in that case, he becomes platoon commander, but he's of sergeant rank. But invariably, it was a platoon officer, a one pip or a two pip. Now, you wait until, say you've got four or five guys coming in. You wait until they're right slap bang in the middle. Then the word of command is given, open fire. In which case, the middle section just opens up everything. And don't forget, the The officer's probably got an American automatic carbine. The sergeant may have an automatic carbine or an Owen, and you might get the other three invariably have got a jungle rifle. Now, usually, not always, but usually the we found that bandits caught in this situation went either right or left. Sometimes, but not always, they went straight, you know, backwards. But they would try and run out of the situation, either to the right or left. And this is the idea of your stops. Because any stray people that are not caught in the middle section will be caught whether they're running out right or left. And the brain gun has usually got, you know, it's got such a rapid arc of fire that it will cut down anything in between. And not only that, if they do go that way, they can always swing across, and you're not endangering your group in the middle. And that is how we found that most of the ambush situations worked very, very well. So everybody in your patrol is on one side of the track. You're not sitting right on the track, you're back from the track, because usually a track may be only 18 inches, 2 foot wide. And you want enough room between you and the track to hide you, which it's not difficult in those situations, but you want to be well out of the way. You don't want to be sitting right bang on the track. So you might be 15, 20, 25 yards back. And that is an ideal situation that you want. Preferably if you've got a bank, if you're up a bank where you can fire down. You don't really want to be in a position where you're firing up. It's better to have a bank. But if you've not got a bank, well, you know, fairly flat terrain is okay.
And given the conditions, if it was a nighttime ambush, would flares be used to illuminate the situation?
No. We never used flares. The only time you use flares is if you're in a camp position, because they will kick off a flare. At least you know something's going on. But in a night ambush, no flares.
So how easy is it to see given
you can't.
Conditions?
You're relying on a lot of luck. I'll tell you an incident a little bit later on about that. It's difficult, but I mean, again, it depends. You're relying a lot on your platoon commander's intuition. I mean, you can lay there for hours on end, and you imagine things. I mean, there's lovely stories. Anybody that's been in that situation will tell you. You may have heard it before. There was a thing out there called fireflies. They're like a little glowworm with wings. Now, I've been in the situations where you've seen these. We've been laying in an ambush position all night long, and you see these things, and they're this, and you swear that people are walking along, and you think, do I or don't I? But you can't, because you're not getting the word of command. But for a young platoon commander who's probably got even less experience than you, or the same experience of you. I mean, we've had situations where, obviously, as the time goes on and you're with the battalion longer, you're getting drafts coming out all the time from the UK, and they're bringing new blokes with them and new, young, National Service subalterns who go through the same training as you, but then they get saddled with a platoon. They're in charge of 15 or 20 blokes. Now, the blokes that they're taking out know more about the situation than they do. So you can imagine, put yourself in their position. I've got 15, 20 blokes under my command. They know more than I do. Do I fight? They rely very heavily on the platoon sergeant, who's usually got lots of experience, or the corporals. I mean, the guy that shot Lu Kong Kim, Lieutenant Hans. We had a situation in our battalion that when you had about a month to do before you came home, you were stood down off operations, but you went on to training drafts that were coming out from the UK. Now, I can remember, it just stands out in my mind. We had already been stood down. This is coming towards the end of my period with the battalion. And we were on training. And Lieutenant Hans was assigned to us to take out on patrols, just training patrols, not into any dangerous situation where, you know, we would have been got a lot of casualties. But he came to our section with a lot of other guys, and he was about my height. He was about 5'4", very slim, a very insignificant young man. And we thought, blimey, you know, he looks just like one of the boys. And lo and behold, a few months later, he was the guy that was in charge of, I think it was Fire Platoon B Company, that went out and shot one of the most notorious bandits in the whole of the Malayan campaign. And, I mean, if you saw him today, you just wouldn't recognise him. He's on this Empire Warriors thing. But, I mean, it must have been quite an awesome prospect for some of these young subalterns to come out and find themselves. Well, I mean, I suppose it is for any subaltern to come out and find that they're in charge of a section of men, no matter whether it's Korea or Malaya or anywhere else. If they've never been in action before, and they're responsible for 25 blokes' lives. I mean, I can remember one of the first times I actually went out on patrol. We had a major with us, and this major had come directly from the UK. He'd had virtually no jungle training at all, but he decided to take us out, and we went out with a party of Malay police, and we were out for about an hour, and somebody opened up on us. We never really found out who it was, and everybody hit the deck. And in all honesty, I couldn't get down quick enough. And I thought, so if I had a spade, I would dig a bloody great trench and dive in it, because I was absolutely shit scared. I've never been so frightened in all my life. And it's just reaction. You know, I mean, I think you asked before, were you scared? That was probably the only time I was scared. Scared is not the right word, as I said before. You're very, very apprehensive. But you've got all that adrenaline pumping, and you're all in the same boat. You don't know where it's coming from, because you can't see anything. And I think probably this is why a lot of blokes didn't seem to mind that when I raised this question the other day. If I'd have seen 20,000 bloody screaming Chinese coming at me over the hill, I think I'd have run a bloody mile. But because you couldn't see anything, you didn't necessarily worry about it. But it's a peculiar position to find yourself in.
Is there a set of formalities that you go through when you've finished a patrol, when you return to camp?
Yes. Once you're given the okay that you're no longer required in a particular area, so you make your way out, and you request transport, the transport takes you back to camp, you jump off your wagons and you line up, and the order's given to unload, and you take out your magazines from your rifle or your Bren or whatever, and then it's clear weapons. You pull back the bolt, and obviously the one up the spout comes whizzing out. You catch that one and put it back, and then the platoon sergeant, usually, or one of the NCOs, it might even be the officer, he will inspect all weapons. He comes along one by one and he sticks his little finger up the breech to make sure that you've not got one up the spout. And then it's ease, the orders go, I think it's a long time ago now, ease springs, and which is you rattle your bolt up and down a couple of times and you pull the trigger and it just goes click to make sure that all weapons are clear. The EY rifleman has the most difficult one, because he's got to take the bit of plastic off of his grenade cup, and he, usually with the help of another bloke, he wiggles the 36 mils grenade out, and he gradually wiggles the clip back into the hole so that the lever doesn't fly off, and then he just sticks that back on his belt. And again, he has to clear his weapon as well, because he fires around without the taper bullet in the end. It's almost like a blank. It's just a charge that will be enough to set the grenade off. And then you're given the order to dismiss. Any rations that haven't been consumed, and invariably there's not many, they go back into the stores. The first thing you do, you go back to your tent. You strip off all your clothing, and either that, if it's badly worn or torn, it's just dumped. This is why I said we were never ever conscious of not getting everything we wanted out there. Nobody ever asked any questions about, oh, you know, this is the third pair of jungle boots you've had in a month. If you didn't have a decent, serviceable pair of jungle boots, you couldn't go out and patrol. So nobody ever took any notice. You just went along to the stores and you signed and you got a new pair, or you got a new lot of kit. Nobody ever, there was no qualms about equipment. Or if your equipment usually went in the wash, and you went and had a nice shower, and then you came back, and then the next thing, the most important thing, is you clean up your weapon. You give that a really good clean and oil, and then it's ready for the next time, and then you might have, I don't know, 2 or 3 days off. In camp, you're still subject to duties. I mean, invariably, you didn't get stupid things like guard, because although if you're in a rifle company, there is people in within that area that are attached to you, but are headquarter company. So you might get the clerks or the company people, the bods in the company office. They would mount guards around the camp. It wasn't up to rifle companies to produce men for guards. And you just relaxed. You played football or badminton, or you had a good drink in the... There was a sort of naffy for everybody, but it wasn't run by the naffy, it was run by the battalion. We used to get 50 free-issue cigarettes a week. These used to come in round tins with a peel-off foil top. They varied from Players, Kensitas, but the favourite one out there was Rough Rider, produced by WD&HO Wills. And there were another couple of local brands, although WD&HO Wills Rough Riders was a British-made cigarette. It was like a weight or a woodbine. But it was produced for British troops and it was for export only. Two famous beers out there were Carlsberg and Tiger. Tiger beer at that time was a peculiar beer, and I actually asked about Tiger beer later on. Apparently, it was a locally produced beer. It still is, but it, these days it's on a much more sophisticated basis. It's produced like all the other major beers. But in those days, I was told, after I inquired about Tiger beer, about the manufacturer of Tiger beer, because why I inquired about it was you could go one night in the Naffy and drink a dozen bottles and walk out the same as you'd walked in. Another night you'd go into the Naffy and you'd have two bottles and you'd be absolutely pissed and paralytic. And our blokes couldn't understand this. They'd say, I had 12 of these last night and I was as right as rain. And we spoke to a bloke in the police force. He said, if I took you down to where they manufacture Tiger beer, you would be amazed. He said, it comes along on a conveyor belt. He said, but the bottles are never filled to the same height. He said, one bottle might be half full, one bottle might be three quarters full, and the other one might be full right up to the brim. He said, and there's a bloke at the end of the line with a jug, and in this jug is reputedly absolute alcohol. He said, and he just tops it up. He said, that's why sometimes you can drink 12 bottles and not be drunk, and another time you can only drink two and you'd be stoned out of your mind. Whether this was true or not, we have no proof, but I can assure you this is what the blokes found. You could drink all night long and be stone cold sober some nights, and other nights after about two or three bottles you didn't know which way to turn. Remembering that the battalion had been in Malaya since early 1949, and we joined it in sort of 50-ish thereabouts. One incident that I well remember, because when I was posted, I went to D Company, and there were three platoon commanders in D Company that had quite a reputation for bandit killing. We had Lieutenant Kelly, who was known to the boys as Killer Kelly. There was Lieutenant Charrington and Lieutenant Starling, who everybody referred to as Joe. Now, Joe, over the years since he joined as a regular soldier, and he had quite a distinguished army career. Sadly, he died in about 1997 or 1998, I think it was. But he reached the rank of brigadier through his career, and he had a very, very illustrious military career. But when he was with us, he'd come straight from Sandhurst. But by the time we reached the battalion, he'd already won an MC in Malaya. He was marvellous. He was one of these officers. He would never go anywhere, or he would never tell his blokes to go anywhere where he wouldn't have gone himself. He was always follow me, lads, not you go and I'll come after you. He was marvellous. One incident, we were out in, I think it was Dinkle Swamps, and we had a tracker with us, an E-Ban or a Diac, I can't remember which now, and we were going along this track, and the tracker thought he saw a footprint in the track, and he told the platoon commander that he could smell cigarette smoke. Nobody else in the patrol could smell cigarette smoke at all. So anyway, Joe decided to carry on for a little while, and lo and behold, we came upon an empty camp. We found a quantity of food, about four or five beds, all made from bamboo. But the tracker thought that the bandits had probably moved further into the swamp area. So the patrol went on a bit further. Several yards actually into the swamp area, and the swamp is nasty to patrol in because usually you're up to your waist or even higher in this sort of glutinous matter, and you can't really see what's underneath. There's lots of squelching and cursing under breath, and then we were about, I don't know, we'd gone about another 15 yards, I suppose, and a uniformed bandit appeared in front of the leading scout, and he opened up on the patrol. And then a second one ran out. I think he was killed. Yeah, he was killed. And then a third one came out and fired several shots before running off, or trying to run off through this swamp. I think we got two that day, but I mean, nobody ever knew really who shot who. I mean, I can honestly put my hand on heart and say, if you were to ask me the question, have you ever killed anybody, I can't say yes, I did, because in those situations, everybody opens up, so you don't know who kills who, virtually. People have said to me, didn't you feel queasy? No. Because it's either them or you, you know. I mean, if you're confronted with somebody that's firing at you, it's instinctive. You just open up and you're given the word of command, open fire, and you open fire. You don't question whether, you know, am I doing the right thing or the wrong thing? It's just, it's something that you do. It's a bit, you can't really explain it in terms of, you know, is it right or is it wrong?
And how quickly will an incident like that unfold, and how quickly is it over with?
Seconds. Seconds, probably a minute and a half. It's the aftermath, really, when everything quietens down. You start searching. You know, you're wondering all the time, is there anybody still out there keeping an eye on, got their beady eye on you, sort of thing.